What's going on, everyone? We are back for our third episode, and this time we actually have a special guest. Her name is Angela Luna. Like last week, we had a discussion about sustainability and things like that, so we wanted to kind of continue the conversation. But first, we're going to start off with a little bit of like what happened in Paris Fashion Week. So,
and Milan, because we have to give a shout out to Moschino.
Yes.
Because his runway show was brilliant with the puppets. Oh my God.
It was, I think that was kind of really clever of him, because I feel like now these brands are trying to think of ways to be clever when it comes to like the pandemic and showing their collection in a very unique way where there's still kind of like a social distancing, but still kind of like, oh, we're still in this weird time in our lives. We can't, you know, we can't have as many guests as we used to. And I thought that was just a unique way of doing it. Like, it was just magical. Even the collection itself, like just looking at it from like a puppet size. So if you go to, I think it's Vogue, right? Vogue Runway.
You could do that or on his Instagram. That's where I saw it.
If you go to Moschino's Instagram or even Jeremy Scott's Instagram, you can see the collection. Basically, what he did is create a full collection of, I want to say 50 looks maybe, all like made with puppets. So basically the collection was puppet sized, and then he had like a whole runway show of just puppets and people in the stand, people watching, or puppets watching the show, which is pretty interesting.
It's genius. And then he had himself as a puppet as well at the end.
Yeah.
He had Anna Wintour.
Uh-huh. Honestly, when I saw Anna Wintour, I was just like, what?
Did he have to get her approval to do something like
that? I mean, I would think so. Like, Anna Wintour is not going to come for that.
Like, could you do that now in the future? Oh, Anna Wintour was there.
But do you really, I mean, I don't think you really need her approval, because I mean, it's just a puppet. It's not really her. Yeah?
I feel like you would.
Maybe, yeah. Okay.
I think you would.
I found it so interesting. I just was like, wow, this is actually pretty cool. Like, hats off. Like, that was just really cool. Another collection that I think me and her both loved was Dior. I'll be honest. At first, I looked at it, and I was just like, it's too bohemian. Like, it was just way too, like, bohemian. Like, it was just, I just felt like, where is Dior? Like, the codes and, like, the signatures of Dior. You know, like, the new look, like.
But they can't keep doing the same thing, otherwise you're going to get bored.
But there's an essence
of Dior in there.
There is, but I felt like I was looking at, Ulla Johnson than I was looking at Dior.
Really?
That's how I felt. And then I was just like, but then I watched the video, because I only saw the photos. Then I watched the video. Then I read the review from Vogue. And honestly, I was like, oh, I get it now. It was very like Italian Renaissance, very like nomadic, but still had little essences, like you said, of the Dior like signatures. Like the cinch waist, the oversized. Like, she's really trying to define what this Dior woman should be. And I think it's good, but I feel like it's kind of taken away a little bit from like what was presented. Because with John Galliano, he still kind of.
Just can't compare anyone to John Galliano.
I know, but he still kind of used the codes from prior, before he became creative director, and still made it into what it is. And I feel like this designer, Maria, she's doing a great job. Don't get me wrong. I love her designs. I feel like it was just a little too much, or a little too, you know, creative. But I don't know how else to explain it. But like, all in all, it's just like, I didn't see Dior, but I do love the collection. No. The music, I felt like the music kind of played into it a little bit for me. I know you didn't like the music.
I hated the music.
It was very operatic.
It was weird. It was like yodeling.
It was opera.
It took away from me.
I think it made sense to me, in a sense. It made sense. Like, I got the entire vision, the entire story. After listening to it, seeing the runways show, so seeing the looks, seeing the scenery itself, like where she did, where she presented the show, I was like, okay, I got it. I understand it. And I like it. After doing that, I was like, I like it now. I love it. But before, I was like, just seeing it with the slideshows, I was just like, nah, I don't know. But then I was like, okay, got it.
I loved all the embroidery, the color story, just how it seemed effortless.
Yeah.
It wasn't so tailored, but it was yet still like showing the silhouette without being like,
right. technically, as in like the design techniques that she used, it was superb, like amazing. Like she did a great job. Obviously, like with a brand like Joy, she's obviously gonna have talented designers to kind of create this collection. So techniques and construction wise, I had no issues. I felt like, I didn't see any Dior essence, but then after a while, I was like, okay, I get it. Now I get it. And I think she's kind of recreating what Dior is.
She's modernizing it.
Yeah, now in the 21st, Yeah. 21st century. Yeah.
So, I mean, you have the classic Dior. You have John Galliano's just costumized
Dior.
And like the whole fantasy. Right. Then you have, I don't know what happened. And then you have her modernizing it and making it what it is today, which I think, like, it's pretty good.
It is really good. It is really good. And I really enjoyed this collection. And I actually really enjoyed the show. I wish I was there just to kind of see everyone's point, you know.
I'd always wish we were all
there. I know, but, you know. But then, so then segue into another brand, Balmain. I love Balmain. Like,
I'm not saying I don't love Balmain. I just didn't care for that collection. It was, there's no, I only had their one print, which looks like a copy of Versace and Fendi, but we'll get into that like later.
Yeah, we'll get into that later. But I honestly, so if you go into Balmain's spring summer 2021 collection, Vogue Runway, all that stuff, you'll see the video. They have a live stream video on their platform now, so which is pretty cool. They have it for all these brands as well. So it started off with just like older models, like wearing the new monogram prints now. So you know how like Fendi, Dior, Fendi has the double F, Chanel has the double C, Balmain has the B, but it's like it looks like a double F if you like.
It's like a P within a B.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Basically. And so now every design or every part of their designs, it's kind of like a print, like a monogram print that's in their designs or something like that. But anyways. So yeah, they started off with these, you know, older, more like models from like, I don't know, the 70s or something like that. They start walking and then they start wearing their clothes. It's so interesting because a lot of these models almost fell, which was, I was like, oh my God. But I think it's because of the way they were walking or whatever the case may be. So, and then it kind of went into the collection. So you see it's made into like, neon green or neon like
neon green the neon colors like black and gray kind of, and then like the denim,
right? Exactly.
Those are the colorways.
And it was just, I honestly loved how it kind of came about or how it like walked the runway, because it just seemed so chic, so powerful, so like effortless. The only thing I didn't like was the the exaggerated shoulders and then the bell bottoms. I'm like, it just looks like a bell bottoms everywhere. Like throughout the entire collection, bell bottoms and exaggerated shoulders. And that's, I guess that's Balmain's signature, the exaggerated shoulders, but still it was kind of like, is there more?
It's funny that you say you didn't like those two things, and that's pretty much all I saw in the whole collection. Yet this is one of the collections you liked, which is kind of weird.
I know, it is kind of weird. But no, I like as a whole, the collection was amazing. Came out perfectly. It was tailored. It was just a beautiful sight to see. The only thing was, I felt like there should have been a little bit more different like silhouettes. And they did. But I felt like I was just seeing a lot of bell bottoms and a lot of exaggerated shoulders. I can get over the exaggerated shoulders. I can't get over the bell bottoms. I feel like bell bottoms are, I feel like they should stay in the 70s. They should just stay in the 70s.
But I just wish there was more variety in silhouettes. And to have such tailored jackets and tailored pants, and then except for the bell bottoms that kind of flared out. But then the dresses were, it looked like the model just kind of got fabric, threw it on, and pinned it, and that was it.
Right. Yeah. I agree. So, well, all in all, I feel like Paris is doing a really good job so far. So I'm excited to see what's next. I think they're supposed to end next week or something. Monday? I think they end on like... No, I think they end this Sunday or even tomorrow. Or today's Thursday. They end Saturday. Because I know they go a little bit into October. So yeah, so I'll be watching. I'm kind of excited to see what Chanel does, especially now. But I feel like Chanel is not really going to... It's not going to do anything creative. They're just going to be like staying the same, I feel like.
We'll see.
Yeah.
Can't say it until we see it.
Because, I mean, the resort season was awful. Awful. So bad. So bad. But, you know. So, yeah, we're going to get into our guest, Angela Luna. So, this is exciting. We're excited to talk to her.
So, please welcome my friend from college and still friend today, the founder and CEO of Adif, Angela Luna. Say hi.
Hi, guys. Thanks for having me.
Of course.
Of course.
So, with the podcast labeled, we are dedicated to talking about fashion and how to start a brand. So, Angela is a perfect representation of starting a brand from scratch and gearing it towards a sustainable future. So, Angela, tell us a little bit about your brand and how it got started.
For sure. So, you've known me since, like, the first day I started this brand. Even before then, actually, back when it was just a project. But Adif really grew out of my senior thesis collection at Parsons, where I was really trying to investigate the role that clothing could have in global issues in the world. At the time when I started the company, started the project, the refugee crisis was really the main global issue in the world, and my senior year I just became very disheartened at the fashion industry and how it didn't really seem to connect in any way in any form to the actual issues that were going on in the world. So decided to see if there was a way for me to do that through clothing, not just through product design but also in design. So started just as a school project and then presented and won a lot of awards for it, which was great and helped kind of put me in a spotlight to actually continue it forward to become a brand. And have been running it for, oh my God, it's been 4 years now, which is terrifying. Yeah, 4 years. So graduated in 2016, so it is now 2020. But I will say, I don't think that we really started as a company until like 2 years ago, which was when we were able to open our own factory in Greece that employs refugees and kind of expand to a full collection. Before that, we were very product, you know, one-off product based. And now I would say that we're actually a proper brand. So it's taken some time.
That's awesome. I wanted to ask, this started off as like one of your thesis projects, right? And you kind of, after college, you wanted to pursue it full time. What were the like obstacles that you like endured, whether it was financially or like anything that kind of like was like, oh, am I doing this right? Or what were they? So people, our audience will have an idea.
They happen every day. Obstacles. I will say the first one is always financial obstacles. So when you're starting a business, we started from scratch. Literally started from the money that my mom gave me to make the collection in school, which is just like, you know, it's like normal for your parents to pay for your supplies. My mom sponsored me by paying for the fabric. And so that was like the first, I guess, an investment. And then from that, managed to get a grant from Parsons when I graduated. That was only like $5,000. And I really built everything from that $5,000 grant and then, you know, turned that into a crowdfunding campaign to do sample development, then a Kickstarter campaign to do the first production. So it's been like every single time that we want to expand, it's like, okay, how are we going to do that? How are we going to introduce new products, or how are we going to open a factory? It's always just kind of been like, you know, these short-term temporary goals for smaller amounts of money, but at the time it means everything to you. But yeah, I mean, like, financial things are always a stressor. The, you know, COVID-19, the fashion industry super hard, and in the spring, we had the huge obstacle of like, okay, where do we stand? What do we do here? And you kind of have to pivot constantly. You know, so many times I've released something and been like, oh, okay, that's actually not working. How do we turn it into something else? I mean, I will say our manufacturer for the spring and throughout the entire and into this fall has changed from making accessories to producing protective equipment, gear, things like that.
Right.
That we're then selling and then donating to hospitals. So it's kind of, it's constantly just being, I will say just being an entrepreneur is being able to adapt and take information and not let that stick, like not continue on that exact same path that you had set. It's being able to take that new information and then look at where you come and say, you know, what's working and what's not and where you should go from that.
Okay, cool. Nice. That's awesome.
So I'm sure there's more people wanting to start a sustainable fashion brand. What advice would you give them in terms of finding the material, kind of branding that, and I guess overall getting the funds for something like that?
So, I mean, luckily there's a lot more sustainable brands coming up. Every day I'm meeting like other new designer babes, and that's really exciting to see. Like it's kind of, it's basically a standard now. If you want to be a designer, you have to have some element of sustainability. And I will say, it's not as simple as just buying, you know, organic cotton or recycled polyester. Truly being a sustainable brand means thinking about circularity, which means thinking about the end use of a garment from the minute that you're designing. So I know typically we think of like, oh yeah, we'll just design this thing and put it out in the world. And then if someone, you know, when they're done with it, they'll just, you know, donate it or resell it or something like that. But the job of a sustainable designer is to really think beyond, you know, that end point of the customer and figure out where this actually ends up in the waste of the world. And if there's a way to integrate it back into your design process or integrate it into other systems that's not going to cause harm to those, that's kind of a really key thing. So that's kind of like the first thing is I would say, like, when you're designing, don't just think about, you know, what you're putting into this garment. Think about this, the impact this garment will have. Beyond, you know, it leaving your studio, beyond it being worn, even to the end of its life. And I will say where it comes to materials, there's so much waste in the world. And I really feel like the easy way out is just to kind of look at what the mills have that is a sustainable fiber. But beyond that, there's already just so much textile, like, already created in landfills or in dead stock, you know, back rooms of warehouses that should be leveraged. And there's really no need to create any new textile to begin with because we have enough and it's going to be on our planet for, I don't know, thousands of years to come. So I would really say, like, I would encourage any new designer to think of innovative ways to leverage waste as a resource, whether that's through upcycling, whether that's through repair. There's a lot of different opportunities there. And yeah, really just try to think of new ways to design products, new ways to create systems of recycling and all of that. It really goes beyond just making the product itself.
That's pretty cool. So I don't know if you, I can't remember if you said this in the beginning, but did you originally start off as a sustainable, I know it was more of like, you know, the social or the injustice of like refugees and all that stuff, but did you originally start off with sustainability? And if so, what kind, or if not, or if so, what kind of prompted you to be like, oh, so I want to do this in, with sustainability?
Absolutely, yeah. Really good question because I didn't touch on that before. But what really inspired me to create the brand in the first place was more the human rights issue. And sustainability was a priority back then, but it wasn't necessarily a cornerstone of the brand. Obviously, we would use like milled polyester that was recycled and things like that. But it wasn't until like 2 years ago when we really started to pivot and acknowledge the really detrimental impact climate change having to these human rights issues that we were actually trying to address. So, you know, it's like you see the effects of climate change and sustainability creating more refugees. And just by us making new things in general, whether it was to sell or to donate, we were, you know, in a roundabout way contributing to the refugee crisis just from the climate change perspective. So that was kind of when we looked internally and said, okay, we have to either stop making things or figure out a better way to make things. And that was kind of when we decided to open up our own factory in Greece that would hire refugees. So we kind of shifted away from donating products to homeless or to refugee populations to actually creating long-term jobs. But then also moving forward to actually not using any mill fabric whatsoever. So we kind of set the goal to eventually move towards only upcycled materials to go in our factory. So it means no ordering organic cotton, no ordering recycled polyester. We were only going to use waste materials that either were collected in Greece or, you know, are from different issues, such as like tents that refugees have lived in, to, you know, dead stock garments from other brands, to donated clothing, to even broken umbrellas. So really trying to be innovative of where we can find material to create new things. And that's kind of where we are today.
That's really cool.
But now how do you use this material? Like, is it all patchy together or?
That is the design challenge. that is where aesthetics come in. And that's where, unfortunately, like I do have to have a lot of oversight. And that's the challenge of like making things scalable and being able to be replicable, because it really takes a design eye to be able to have certain pieces put together in that way. And I will say, through streamlining materiality, if you're using the same fiber, using the same weave, if it is patched together, it looks more just like seam lines than like a madras kind of patchwork that you would traditionally know. I hate patchwork. I remember when I first started doing fashion, like as a 10-year-old, we'd go to Joann Fabrics and just all this quilted bullshit. I don't want to do this. Like, this is gross. So it's honestly the biggest irony now is me coming around and trying to make patchwork look good. But I will say, yeah, a lot of it, because like when it comes to upcycling, it depends on the size of the canvas you're working with. Like the tents that we use, that's huge swaths of fabric. It's like yards long, whereas when we're using umbrella tops, you know, we're piecing it together. We have a special way of doing it that it looks more aesthetic to my ideals.
But, yeah,
it looks less like, you know, random patches and more just like a print created through seam lines. But that you know, you requires a lot more patching, a lot more work, because it's like, you know, these triangles of space that you're using to create basically a new flat piece of textile that you can cut your pattern piece out of. It's a little bit different from, like, I would say most concepts of upcycling. We try to avoid having like the random shapes of patches, because I think that's what's really messy. So it's kind of on us. This is where we have our design input of like, beyond just, you know, what our silhouettes are going to be or what our shapes are going to be, how can we actually design the textile itself?
That's really cool. So you mentioned that you went to Greece to find a factory, or you built a factory out there. What was the process like, if you built the factory or if you found a factory, and then did they already have those like sustainable practices in place?
Well, first I'll say it was the biggest challenge I think I've ever had in my life, was creating a factory overseas. So we built a factory.
Okay.
We hired a team of refugee tailors who we actually met because they were volunteering for a nonprofit organization that had their own little sewing studio where they would create these tote bags and give them as gifts to people for donation. And so right as we kind of approached some nonprofits that we're friends with in Greece, we said like, oh yeah, by the way, like we're trying to start a factory. If you know of any refugee camps that, you know, are interested in having us set up a system there. And one of them came back and said, oh, actually, there's a nonprofit that already has a sewing center. And so I reached out to them and they're like, we're about to lose our funding for the sewing center. We're trying to find jobs to transition our tailors over to. And so it was kind of like perfect timing, very, you know, serendipitous, seamless transition from them closing down that section to us starting that. So we were able to hire over almost all the guys who were working there before. And I will say, if I had known how hard it was going to be at the beginning, I don't think I would have done it. It was just like, we literally had to create a Greek company. So I have, you know, an American company, and I have a Greek company. And the process of creating an entity in Greece, it's like the most backwards thing in the whole world. Like, everything. Like, there were times, like, in the past 2 years where it was easier for me just to fly to Greece to sign papers than to just go to the Greek consulate and do whatever I had to do. So I was back and forth pretty much every month for the first, like, 6 months of us creating the factory there. Luckily, everyone we hired had experience with sewing. I will say, like, they are the most amazing sewers and tailors I've ever met. Like, they sew circles around me.
Yeah.
Normally, I can't figure something out, and I'll show it to them, and they'll be like, oh, duh, you're so stupid. So, like, it's honestly just, like, it's a privilege to be able to work with them and have their craft applied to our pieces. And where it comes to sustainability, they haven't had that much experience with it aside from, you know, them living in Greece and working for this nonprofit. The nonprofit they work for didn't want to buy fabric, they couldn't afford fabric, so they basically just got really scrappy with any, you know, waste material they would find. So luckily they have experience with, you know, the nature that comes with upcycling, which is like cutting around stains or trying to make the most of a piece of fabric. But where it is, like, you know, like the sustainable patchwork and these different kind of aesthetic things, it's a little bit new to them. So yeah, it's just kind of a learning process, and it's a growing process as well.
Awesome. And do you, like, for your factory in Greece, do you have other clients kind of like come in and be like, oh, can you create this so that, so it's like a double business? It's like your product is being made there and then they have other clients coming in?
That's actually what we're trying to transition more into.
Okay.
So we originally started just producing our own collection, but I always said, you know, our goal here is sustainable manufacturing and ethical employment. So it shouldn't just end with us. Like, we should be creating things for other companies because we want to extend the mission of what we're doing here. We can make their clothing sustainably, we can make it ethically, we can make whatever they want, basically. And that would allow us to expand and hire more people and create, like, a larger impact. So originally, I mean, we first started just producing for ourselves while we worked on contracts. And now, I will say that's kind of like a main cornerstone of our business and where we're actually planning on growing into. You know, my goal for the next few years isn't to just be a brand. I think we're kind of transitioning more into being sort of a design studio with a manufacturing component, because it's really through these collaborations, both for manufacturing and for design, that allow us to have the largest potential impact within the factory.
That is amazing. I think that would be a good, I think that would be good, because there's a lot of, especially personally, I know a designer who is trying to be sustainable and she doesn't know any other manufacturers in California, which is where she lives, to do that. So she's been looking overseas and she's been like, it's been hard for her to find that. So, you know.
Exactly. And I will say too, I mean, like, we tried to work with factories that would upcycle, you know, post-consumer waste, which is like, you know, existing clothes or whatever, to deconstruct it and turn that into new textile. And every single factory we approached didn't have a system in place.
Right.
So we're trying to create the system so that way other people can use it. And also doing things at, like, a smaller scale. If you're a new designer, it's impossible to get a factory to work with you because you only need a few hundred units as opposed to several thousand.
Right.
When we have our own manufacturing, we can have more control over what we're actually making. If we want to stop a style mid-run, if we want to make new, and working with other designers, like, it's a goal of ours to work with other emerging designers and large designers as well. So having that flexibility in terms of production is really important.
That's great, because, I mean, after you said you wouldn't do this if you knew all the work that went into it, I'm sure there's a bunch of other designers who would be like, oh, no, I can't.
Yeah, and
honestly, I got it set up, so just come to hang out with me.
Okay.
Because I feel, keep interrupting
it's
you.
It's okay. No, but I was going to say, I feel like a lot of entrepreneurs, even sometimes me, like, yesterday, we were talking, I was just, like, stressed out because there's this designer that I'm waiting for a product to come in, and it's like, we're already into the fall, winter season, and I'm like, I need the product. How am I supposed to sell? How am I supposed to, you know, make the profit? And it's just like, you think about these things where you're just like, if I knew how hard this process was, would I do it? And it's like, half the time, I think I'm like, would I do this? But, like, I feel like the struggle and the hardships kind of make it exciting and make it fun. So that's why I'm like, I continue on to it, you know?
Yeah,
it also creates the great stories too. Like, no good story comes from something that was easy.
Right.
Like, it's always the...
That's true.
Oh yeah, I was walking around Greece, cold calling the numbers listed on buildings because there's no like Craigslist in Greece to find a base for an office. You have to literally call and get hung up on by everyone because you don't speak Greek. So. Mm-hmm. That's the stories that you get.
But it's a good thing that she's making it easier because yeah. I know if people had, it was more accessible to people to make a sustainable mm-hmm. brand, mm-hmm. they would. And right. that's better for our future because I know like starting my brand, it's hard.
It's like, hard.
There's minimums to reach. I don't know the first thing about creating sustainable. I mean, I know one of the suits I'm making is going to be out of hemp, and I'm like, there you go. But then I'm dying it. So I'm like, did I really do anything?
Right, yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. No, it's challenging. And I mean, any way that we can kind of help other designers too, that's a goal of ours. And also just like the larger companies that are taking so much longer to kind of getting around to doing things well, I'm like, what actually sells the best for us is our story. Mm-hmm. And it's the, you know, employing refugees, it's the mission, it's the, you know, solution-based product design, it's the upcycling. So the best way for us to actually, one, create an impact, but two, create a profit, is learning how to sell our story the best way mm-hmm. and selling, licensing that out basically to brands that haven't done that yet.
Mm. I have a question to that. So I know with Adif, there's like a more of like a tech, like there's a patent, right? There's like yes. a patent with some of your product.
Congrats, by the way.
Right. Congrats. she told me, I think last week, and I was like, oh, wow, that must have been a hard process. So can you walk us through that process? I know it's probably like, I don't want to think about it. It's done. But if you could walk us through. Yeah.
To a system, mm-hmm. don't get a patent. Okay. I should not have gotten this patent. unless you have a patent to a system, or you have a patent attorney as a friend or a family member who is going to help you file for like half the price,
mm-hmm.
then for sure go for it. But we were told that a patent, so we got both a design and a utility,
mm-hmm.
Which utility is really challenging to get for a fashion brand because usually like fashion's it's so easy to replicate, but we right. were patenting the jacket that turns into a tent and the specific function and feature on the jacket that was innovative, I guess, in a clothing publication. So we were originally told it was going to be like $10,000 all in to get the patent, and it would take 6 years. $40,000 later.
Wow.
We need another $20,000 to pay. Like, what? Like, this is ridiculous. Like, wow. There's literally no way you've bankrupted, like, my family, like, paying for this patent that we were told we needed to even sell the product. And at this point, you know, already selling the product, we'd applied for the patent, so we had, like, copyright protection. But honestly, that doesn't stop anyone from copying anything. So finally, this past summer, we stopped working with our attorneys because we just couldn't afford the fees anymore.
Right.
And we let the patent die, I guess, technically. And then we found out, like, through a roundabout way that we'd actually gotten approved, but we didn't get the email, we didn't get the letter in the mail saying we were approved, and then we actually got the patent. Had to, like, pay all these extra fees to revive it, but finally, yeah, we got it. And at this point, I'm like, we're not even selling this. Like, we have, like, 10 minutes left of this style. We're not
going
to
make it again.
Oh, wow.
Oh, my God.
It's going to be a completely different style. And also, that doesn't stop people from attempting to copy you. I mean, like, one of the collaborations that we have lined up for next year was from a designer who literally tried to copy us.
Oh. And
luckily, we're able to, you know, pitch the story as a selling point and like, hey, by the way, it makes more sense for you to work with us on this than to just take this due to the nature of the brand. But that's all I can say on that for this year.
Ooh, I was going to ask, do we know this brand? But I don't know.
We know this brand.
Okay.
Because I know, I remember when I was at work and I saw like Fashion Week and there was this brand and I thought, oh my God, they literally copied my entire friend's idea.
Wait, I know who it is. Okay, now I know. Okay.
You just need to go back a year. If we're thinking of the same person, they were not.
It was about a year ago.
Yep.
I was lucky enough, like this is hustling 101. I was like, I gotta know someone who knows, I'm not gonna name the gender, who knows them, and hustled my ass off and found out that one of my professors professors at Parsons, had a student who works under them at another company that they work for, and was able to pass along their executive assistant's email. And I sent this email, and I was like, there's no way they're going to answer me. 2 hours later, I get an email back saying, like, oh, yeah, we're in. I'm like, okay. Yeah. So, but it took me literally, like, 3 weeks to find that email. I had already had the proposal done. I was just waiting for the right contact.
Wow, that's such a hustle mentality and such a like entrepreneur type mindset to kind of go there and be like, yo, they took something from me, but let me see if I can get some type of cut from it. So that's really dope.
Exactly.
It's
genius. They're going to take it anyway.
Yeah.
Like, whether or not you have a patent, like, I mean, that can scare people off a little bit, but I don't really know. I mean, they're going to take it anyway. So it's like, okay, how do you get a piece of the pie?
Right. Honestly. Yeah. I mean, hey, if you can take my idea, as long as I get some pockets, you know, some keys,
exactly.
Some coins.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. I'm like, help me further my goals and I can help you further yours.
Right. Exactly. That's pretty dope. That's really cool.
Because I remember when I text messaged her, she was just like, yeah, I know. What can you do? And I'm at work like, oh my God, I'm so mad.
Like, now they're kind of coming around saying they want to start their own brands, and I'm like, but they're so afraid of getting copied. They're like, if I even just put something out, it's going to get copied. But I'm like, you can't really let that stop you, because it's going to happen. Mm-hmm. It's just going to happen. There's not really much you can do to protect it. What you can do, though, is on the brand side, have your brand just so unique that can't be copied. The product can be replicated, but if the story associated with that product is so unique to you, whatever copy isn't going to be as valuable.
That's true.
So storytelling within your brand is what's the unique identifier for a specific brand.
Exactly.
Perfect. Mm-hmm. So just to kind of end it off a little bit, what advice, unless you have any other questions that you want to ask Ariel?
Oh, I do have one for refugees, because I know you said you were donating to and you're hiring. What all does your brand contribute to that crisis?
So we've donated, oh my God, I don't know, let me think, what's the number? I think it's up to 2,000 units of product that we've donated to refugees in Syria, Turkey, and Greece, and also homeless in LA.
Oh, cool.
Nice.
Awesome.
And then we currently employ 3 tailors from Afghanistan, looking to expand beyond that, but it's really nice to have an impact, because they all have very large families, and through our salaries, they're able to support their families, both in Greece and back home. So it's really nice to know that we have that sort of an impact. But we also have goals to hire way more people with the expansion beyond that. Keep growing with donations and kind of.
Do you hope to seek maybe like investments, like from, I don't know, venture capitalists, equity, like in angel investors? Yeah.
We actually did receive one angel investment, which honestly, that's talking about challenges as starting a brand. People don't invest in fashion brands unless it's kind of like an Everlane or an Allbirds type of one key product and really going heavy into marketing. But also being a woman in that space is, being challenging too. But anyway, so, it's worth it.
So I guess last question that we're going to ask is, or that I'm going to ask, what advice do you have for someone that wants to start a brand, someone that wants to be an entrepreneur, or someone that wants to start a sustainable brand? What advice would you give them before they start? And then what advice would you give them as they're trying to build it?
First thing I would say, a really important thing to learn is actually what your story is and what your perspective is and how that's different from someone else's brand or story. I later found out, I was like, I thought my story was super unique, and then I found a brand out of the UK who had a very, very similar story, and I immediately took that as like, oh my God, now everything I do unvalidated. But actually, I mean, the more that I've kind of analyzed it and actually become friends with this brand, now start collaborating with this brand, there are a lot of differences there. I will say, try to find your unique angle. Try to find out who is similar, and then also figure out why you are so different from them. That's really important to figuring out, product, branding, what's actually sellable, what's good about it. And then other advice, just go out and do it. Like, There's no right way to start a company. I remember the first, right when I graduated from college, I spent 6 months literally just networking and asking, like, what's the first step? Mm-hmm. Every single person said one step or another was the first step and the other steps weren't that important, but everyone had different opinions on that. So, like, literally, there is no wrong way to start a brand. There is no wrong first step. Just take it.
Awesome.
That's true, because I know too, and I'm always in that mindset. Oh, it has to be perfect, mm-hmm. right from the beginning. Mm-hmm. But no, you can grow, and even
it's a stepping stone. It's a step on the staircase to whatever you're going to.
Right.
Like, even where we are now, I'm like, we're kind of changing, but like everything that we did to get here is important to where we're going. So it doesn't have to be perfect. It just needs to happen.
Right. Yep. That's pretty amazing. Well, thank you so much, Angela. Yes. Like, this was very, I feel like our audience would appreciate this because, you know, you're a entrepreneur for 4 years. You have 2 businesses and you're just growing and growing. So it's just, I mean, I'm saying you have 2 businesses because, I mean, you're about to start this manufacturing thing.
I'm actually about to have a third.
How old are you, by the way, if you don't mind me asking?
I'm 26.
Bro, yeah. Listen, y'all need to hit her up and, like, get some advice because I, like, honestly, there are not that many young entrepreneurs in their 20s. I mean, there probably is, but, I mean, there's not, like, that are actually doing what they said that they're doing. And you've been doing this since...
Yeah, do the damn thing. That's the first step.
Yes, do the damn thing. So, I mean, I think this is... This is very inspiring. It's definitely inspiring me. I'm sure it's inspiring Ariel and our readers. And we just thank you for taking the time to come on, talk about your experience, and talk, you know, educate us on sustainability.
Yeah.
Hey, thank you, guys. Happy to share my information and everything that's going on.
Yes. As we wrap up, can you give us your Instagram handles, anything, your website, whatever, so that way people can support?
Yes, so my personal Instagram is not that exciting to give me business. It is ADIFFNYC Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. That's ADIFFNYC. And our website is just ADIFF.com. Everything should be there. But yeah, follow us.
Yes.
And support her cause.
Support her cause. It's an amazing cause. And I, you know, she's an amazing person. So, you know, why not? So thank you all. If you like this episode, please subscribe, share, comment, tell us more of what you want from our, you know, what we have to offer and things like that. And comment on Angela, see what you know, ask her questions. If you're interested in starting a brand, hit her up. I'm sure you'll respond to DMs and emails and stuff like that. So, thank you guys. Hope you have a lovely day and we'll see you next week.
Bye.
Bye.
Yay. Okay.